This is Shudders Inc. with Bruce Williams and Glyn Lavender.
Hi, and welcome to episode 306 of Shudders Inc. This is Bruce Williams from ShuddersIncPodcast.com, and joining me on the line via Skype from Melbourne once again from creativephotoworkshops.com.au, Mr. Glyn Lavender. How are you?
You know, I'm excited.
Pray tell, why are you excited?
Oh, I've just got a blockbuster of an evening planned. We've got so much excitement ahead.
Right.
That, you know, I'm just sitting here just, I might even listen to this one myself. I might actually sit down and listen to this pod. No, I won't. But it's going to be good, I think. I think you've pulled together some stuff. We're going to talk about your photos from last week,
which
there's going to be some humour there. It's going to be good. So I'm excited to chat with you, and it's a fine. And we're recording on a Friday night for once.
We are, which is unusual.
Which is pretty rare. Yes. Just somebody wussed out yesterday.
So clearly you're feeling better tonight than you were last night.
Oh yeah, it was me. Yeah. I had a bad migraine yesterday, or migraine, depending on which part of the world you're from.
Right.
It's a bit like DP review and deep preview. Yeah, so same kind of thing, tomato, tomato. Really bad last night and really bad night's sleep. And
it's no good.
So, and I've been really drowsy all day, but now I'm perking up.
Right.
It's 10 o'clock at night or whatever, and I'm ready to go.
Excellent. It's not good.
But I've been having a shocking time trying to get to sleep because I've got this elbow problem.
No,
I've got this nerve problem in my elbow, in my left elbow.
Right,
and I can't raise my hand to my face easily because of the pain.
Wow.
So you imagine photography is not so easy.
No.
But even just laying on it is you get this burning pain in your elbow, and it's just been. I think that's what brought my headache on, was just sheer fatigue.
Wow. So, geez, that's not good.
Yeah, not good. Some massive nerve problem and some form of RSI kind of thing, I think. Yeah. You know what the doctor said?
No.
Nothing, because I haven't been to one, of course. I'm a man. I'm a bloke. It's only been happening for 2.5 weeks. Why would I go to the doctor's?
Yeah, right.
Much
don't
to
want
my
to be a wuss. Got to leave it for at least a month.
Much to my wife's disgust. But I have Google doctored, as you should, as every man
of
should.
Of course.
Apparently, the longer you leave it, the more chance of permanent damage you've got.
Right.
So, that makes all the sense in the world.
Battle scars.
Men are hopeless. Men are hopeless. Anyway, so how was your week been?
Mate, not too bad. Not too bad. Yeah. Just after we recorded last week, unfortunately, I missed this by about 15 minutes. Mike Holman posted on Facebook to say that he'd been in a total award hog again. Took out 10 awards at the New Zealand Institute of Professional Photography. Hey?
The Mike Holman Photography Competition.
Yes, that's right.
10 awards.
And he's 1 point shy of Grandmaster.
Yeah. It's like black belt, isn't it?
Something
like
that. Yeah. Pretty much.
He's the ninja of photography.
So congratulations, Mike. Well done, mate.
Yeah, good on you, Mike. Yeah. Everyone's so impressed.
I need to get a bigger shelf for all my awards.
Yeah, Mike during the week posted an iPhone pano shot that he got himself in twice.
Oh, yes, I did see that.
So my comment, of course, is, what, you're trying to find someone to have a competition with in your photo competitions? Let's clone the Mike Holmans. Maybe Mike Holman can beat Mike Holman. And Mike Holman came third. just goes to show that nice things happen to nice people.
That's right.
He's a lovely man, that Mike. And I don't know how much if he's actually doing much training or anything for people, but if he ever does something that's certainly worthwhile, if you're a landscape kind of person, an architectural person, certainly someone to follow and I think that's Holman, Holman,
yep.
Mike.
Well, I've got to say, the day that myself and Kath and Max hung out with Mike and Viv in Auckland, I just had a great time, and I picked up some great tips from him, particularly when we went out to the gannet colony and we were shooting the gannets both.
I don't like gannets.
Why not?
They wet their nest.
They what?
They wet their nest.
Why?
It's a Monty Python joke. It's okay.
Oh, okay.
I thought you were more cultured than you obviously are.
Sorry. No, I'm not familiar with that one. Anyway,
it's called the Bookshop Sketch, and highly worthwhile looking into it.
Right, Okay, then. I got some great tips from Mike that day. So yeah.
He does it so unassumingly, too.
Yeah, he does. He does. Yeah. So.
He just picks up how useless you are, just without, and does without pointing the fact out like I would. You're crap. He gently just suggests.
Yeah,
it's such a nice way of doing it. So good on you, Mike. Lovely for you. And I tell you, if you're one point off becoming a grandmaster, they should just damn well give it to you.
They should.
Quite frankly, they said, "Look, yeah, near enough. Yeah, near enough's good enough."
Yeah.
So congrats, Mike. Yeah. You are our hero.
Yep. So they're going to make him wait 12 months just to earn that one more point.
They probably did it deliberately too. How many do you need? What, it needs 14? Let's judge this one 13.
Yeah.
That'll teach him for winning 10 awards at our bloody award competition.
That's it.
Good on him.
I saw a thing on Digital Photography Cafe through the week.
Did you?
Of the Nikon Coolpix P900.
Yeah.
Which has the ridiculous 83x optical zoom.
Yeah.
And this guy set it up on a tripod in his backyard, starts out with the lens at the wide angle end so you can see his backyard. It's shot in the middle of the day, but you can see the moon has risen in the sky.
Yeah.
And he then zooms all the way out to 83x. And
oh, man.
You can see individual craters on the moon. It is phenomenal.
That's just crazy.
What if you put it from a bridge camera?
What if you put a 2x converter on the front?
Well, you can't because it's a bridge camera, but
imagine. Doesn't it have a filter thread?
Hey?
A converter, not a lens. A 2x converter doesn't have a filter thread.
But I thought the converter had to go in between the lens and the sensor. I didn't think it could go on.
Oh, not a video. I'm talking video one. The old video type.
Oh, okay.
Video converter. I see this all the time from customers. They come in. I've got a telephoto lens and a wide angle lens and my normal kit lens. I bring them all to the workshop and they come to the workshop and what they've got is they've been to America and they've been sold a wide angle lens and a tele lens and the screw on video converters have gone the front of your lens.
Oh right.
And so it's always an American. They get conned all the time.
Yeah right.
And so they're reasonably low quality, but yeah, they used to put them on the front of video cameras.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it'd be interesting if you put a 2x converter on the front of that, 166x zoom, you'd be able to see the dark side of the moon.
You would. So yeah, pretty crazy.
You'd be able to finally prove man landed on the moon because you'd be able to zoom in on the flag.
That's it.
Astounding.
So yeah, I thought that was a pretty crazy video.
That's very cool.
To think that that's, you know, like I said, it's a bridge camera. It's not an SLR. Anyway.
Crazy stuff. Crazy.
I did see through the week the DP review top 10.
DP review?
That's the one. And I was staggered, amazed. Flabbergasted even.
Bit of a big word around Melbourne this week.
Four of the top six were Sony.
Four of the top six.
There was three Canons in the list and only one Nikon.
Man.
Now, obviously, you know, the top 10 most popular cameras on DP Review changes pretty much by the hour. So obviously this was just a snapshot in time.
Yeah.
But I just thought it was interesting to see Sony that high up. And I know I probably sound like a Sony fanboy, but it's only because I'm trying to counteract Zoom's negativity. Fanboy. Hey, what?
Negative moi.
So, yeah, I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
Now the only thing I had from my contribution was my photo shoot from last week. But
yes, let's have a talk about that, shall we? Yeah, you got the studio lights out, you got the model out, you got the meetup group together. How did it all go?
Well, I thought it went okay for what it was meant to be.
What was it meant to be?
It was meant
see
to
if
be
the lights worked.
Just some pretty much.
Did they?
Pretty much they not flash? Much more than that. Yes, they did work.
Did you get any good photos? It's a bit of an in-joke because Bruce posted all these photographs up on the net. And so my Facebook comment, of course, is, I see the lights work. Bruce, did you get any good photos? And it wasn't meant to say these ones are crap. Not as in, did you get any good photos? It's like, did you get any good photos? Other than the ones you... than what you're showing here.
Okay, go on, let rip.
Well, you got them in front of me, so yeah, but that's easily fixed. I'll just put them up on YouTube, and we'll have at it
on Facebook.
So first up, how'd you go? What worked well? What did you struggle with? What did you?
Okay, so only two people showed up.
Okay,
so it was David Kembry and a guy who I'd not met prior to the day, an Indian fella called Prashant, who was a lovely guy.
Yeah. I saw he'd made some comments on the photos and posted some of his own, I think, or made some comments.
Yeah. And so I said to them, you know, I'd set up the backdrop before they arrived, and I said, look, what I had in mind was that we'll start with just one light with no modifier on it, and we'll start with the light at 90 degrees to the model in close, and then we'll move it out further away and see how that changes the way the light interacts with the subject after you've adjusted the power accordingly, of course. And then we'll move the light around to, say, 45 degrees, and we'll work it in close and then out at a distance. And then we'll start introducing modifiers. And so we went to the beauty dish, and then we went to the softbox, and we mucked around with a couple of different backdrops as well. I had a blue and white cloudy backdrop. And I had
that was bad, wasn't it?
The model's mum made the comment. She goes, oh, my God, it's like every school photo I've ever seen.
it's like something from the 80s.
So anyway.
Do they sell tasteful backgrounds where you got that from? where did you post the photographs to? Shutters Inc? Or was it it's probably Sydney Photography.
Oh, it'd be in the Sydney Photographers Meetup group.
Actually,
I think I did put them on my own private Facebook profile as well.
Okay.
From memory.
Let's talk interestingly about the two images. Fortunately, they're straight out of camera, because if they didn't work on this, diabolically bad.
What's diabolically bad?
If that's your post-processed images.
No, they weren't.
So, now, the one where you've done the single light source, no modifier. Yep. The image for the image on the left, the light was about a metre away.
Yep.
And the second one was about 2.5 metres away.
Yep.
So this is the one I really wanted to talk about the most, because you said, notice the difference in how the light wraps around her face.
Yeah.
Just one of the many things we played with in today's shoot.
Yeah.
So you're implying by that the further the light away is, the more it wraps around the face.
Well, that was my experience.
But it's the opposite way. So it's
says who?
Every lighting person who's ever used a light.
Well, you're arguing with the evidence. The evidence is right in front of you.
No. The evidence is not right in front of me.
Okay.
So first up, the closer the light source is, the softer it is and the more it wraps. Okay? So think about a cloudy day versus a sunny day.
Yeah.
Okay? So if you're looking at a sunny day...
Yeah, but the distance to the light source hasn't changed.
Absolutely it has. Where's the light source on a cloudy day?
Okay, fair enough. The cloud light.
It's the sun. It's the cloud. Yeah, so it's a 30-kilometre versus a 93-million-kilometre light source. So the light source on a cloudy day, your gradation from light to shadow is far softer and it wraps further around. So the closer your light source and the bigger it is, the softer it is and the more it wraps. The only thing I can see, and I don't know why, and we'll discuss it, is on the further away, of course, you put your light, the more the inverse square law comes into place, which means the light travels further beyond your subject and therefore can also bounce off something. And then I discussed that with you on the Facebook post, and you go, well, there's nothing there that I could think of that it could have bounced off.
Yeah.
But... look at where the light is coming from that's on that right-hand side.
Yeah, 90 degrees to it.
It's coming from below. To me, the light that's wrapping...
Yeah.
See her eye and her cheek above her cheek is dark. Darker. Below her cheek, where the light... I think the light's bouncing off the ground. I think... What was underneath her? Was she on the white background?
She's on the white backdrop.
Yeah, so the white backdrop is reflecting from the base up to her.
But there had to be something to make the light bend.
It's not bending, it's reflecting.
Yeah.
It's reflecting up from the ground.
But my point is the light, the flash head was at the height of her head.
Yeah.
Right? So even if it left the monoblock at a 45-degree angle down to the floor and then reflected off, angle of reflection is equal to the angle of incidence,
yeah.
Right? So it had to be a 45-degree angle and then bounce off at 45 degrees.
But it meant the light's spreading as it's travelling too, so it's hitting a very large area below her.
Yeah.
And so,
okay, but anything that was greater than 45 degrees is going to shoot off out the other side. It's not going to hit
still
it.
Get some, obviously, you will. You'll still get some reflection.
I don't see how.
The only way
the
I can see
the light, flat.
The only way, yeah, well, it's still going to reflect up. If light's hitting, it's still going to reflect up. I guarantee you.
Reflection is not equal to the angle of incidence.
It is, but you've got a light spreading across lots of planes as it's travelling. Remember, some of them might be travelling down to almost hitting, if we're looking at her left knee to us, so her left-hand side to our eye, it's coming from almost right below her. It could be going straight up. Whatever. I'm guaranteeing you right now, there's no way is that light wrapping around her from a single light source that's not in a massive softbox. If you said to me one was in a softbox and one wasn't, I'd believe it.
Hmm.
But if they're two bare light sources, moving it further away will do absolutely nothing to increase the wrap. But it will introduce other light problems.
Okay.
Where light can be bouncing off something.
All right.
It's the laws of light. I also agree. Without being there and seeing this, I can't tell you what it's reflecting off.
Yeah.
I'm telling you right now it's reflecting off something, because there's no way does light wrap more the further away it is. It's
okay.
Anti everything to do with the light, to do with how light works.
Mm.
Okay. So this is really important. It's a great thing. And it's good that we're not sure, because this is half the fun of photography, is trying to figure out, you know,
yeah, problem solving. Yeah,
it is. It's problem solving. Yeah. It really is. It's a big struggle.
Yeah.
Now, you used a beauty dish on a couple of these shots.
We did. Yeah.
Why? What were you hoping the beauty dish would do?
I wasn't hoping it would do anything.
What did you see?
The point of this day was that a few people had said that they would love to spend some time in a studio situation using studio lighting and modifiers and whatever. And I'd said, when I get back from Borneo, we'll organise something. And so that's what I had done. And so it wasn't, I had no structure for the day. It was just, hey, I've got some gear. You're welcome to come along. We'll organise a model and, you know, we'll play with some different stuff and we'll all learn. Because, I mean, other than the one studio lighting workshop that I did with you, Shelton, and David Honnell about 4 years ago.
Yeah, at least 4 or 5 years, yeah.
Yeah, I've never used, other than one time myself and Chris Bellier rented a studio in Sydney. Other than those two times, I'd never used studio lighting.
Yeah.
I've only ever used speed lights. I'm sorry.
That's what it shows. No, no.
I was learning as well.
That's right. No, I'm not saying you were an expert trying to tell people. What I'm trying to do is get to the part of what are you seeing in these images, and why do you? What makes you think they either worked or didn't work? So what I'm looking for is what do you see? If you want your photography to get better, you've got to be able to look at these images and saying, well, I think this worked, but this and this didn't work, and how do I fix that next time? The only way you get better is saying, well, these are the problems, and try and find the fixes. And understanding what lights and lights a beauty dish is designed to throw very hard shadows.
Is it?
Yeah.
Right.
So when you're showing that shot with the beauty dish, you'll notice her right cheek to our eye, her left cheek right to us is a very hard shadow, because the beauty dish is a much more directional light source. It's going to fall off a lot quicker around any bends. It's not going to wrap.
Okay. Yeah,
it's going to fall off. So that's why it's often used from above. It really sculpts those cheekbones. You see how she's got no really face definition where the light's all at, but where the shadow is, it gives you this really strong line of cheekbone and jaw. And and so that's what the beauty dish is going to do. It's going to bring out those really strong facial features by highlighting the shadow.
Right.
So the name beauty dish is almost kind of funny in a way, because it's not necessarily adding any beauty. A softbox tends to add beauty.
Yeah.
But a beauty dish often adds this much punchier, much harder light, which can be great on some people and incredibly horribly unflattering on other people. I think that's the best of all your shots.
Right.
As far as...
This is... You're referring to the close-up headshot.
Yeah, I think it's the only one where you well, the best exposed shot of all the shots that you've got.
Right.
There's a lot of shots there that look, you know, they're really overblown. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So getting exposure. I mean, once again, this could be just a Facebook monitor thingy, you know.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's a couple of, to me, a really quite hot.
Okay.
But yeah, without seeing the visuals, who can tell? But yes, I like what you did with the beauty. Just as far as you've got that even lighting, there's not a lot of specularity to the light, not a lot of shiny spots to the light.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when we use that as a light source, it's what do we want to light, and what do we want to have in shade or have more texture to? And it's a great tool for that. But I don't know whether it's necessarily having just one cheek like that overly flattering. Yeah, because right. if you look, you notice how it's almost like she's got a big dimple there down towards her chin. So it kind of looks like she's got some sort of growth or some sort of weird, it's all shadow. There's like a crater in the moon or something, happening in the face. So that's what a beauty dish will do. It'll bring out a lot of that kind of stuff, for better or worse. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's not so good.
Right.
And sometimes you don't know until you light someone.
Yeah.
You think it's going to be awesome. You put it on and you go, oh, my God, that's horrible.
So what would you have done? Would you have gone more head-on with it, but from a higher angle?
No. Once again, a higher angle is going to keep the shade. If I wanted to solve that, if I've got it all set up and I want that beauty dish to be the light source, I'd get her to move her nose slightly towards the light. So maybe move towards her right 3 or 4 inches till the light that falls around that side of the cheek. Okay. And then I would move the same couple of steps to my left, so I've got the same composition, the same look of viewpoint, but her face would be much softer because it wouldn't have that big hard shadow. I wouldn't need to do much else other than just move her face a little bit and move my stance a little bit.
Well, how's that different to just bringing the light round to closer?
Well, how much easier is it to move her head? So keep
that's
it simple.
That's not the point. I mean, I suggested a move, and you then told me no, I would have done this, but that would have been.
You could absolutely move the light, but why would you move the hardest thing to move?
Okay.
But the whole point of that exercise in frustration just then is we do that. We'll go and fiddle with the light again. Oh, it's not. Well, you could have got to move ahead 2 inches and it would have fixed the problem.
Right.
But we keep making it hard for ourselves. Mm-hmm. Set it up. Move your subject. Often keep the light where it is. Move your subject in relation to the light and move yourself in relation to the subject and the light. Now, they're the three elements we can change, but the two easy ones are where we stand and where they look. Yeah, moving, especially when you've got slots on stands with sandbags and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And so I look through all those images and I say, look, well, where's the shadow play in them? Where's the light versus shadow play in them?
Yeah.
And is the shadow in interesting spots? So you've got these full length ones of her in front of that gorgeous blue sky back.
Yeah.
Which looks like something out of photo. Looks like the Photoshop where you can get the diffusion clouds or whatever it's called.
Okay,
it looks a bit like that. But note where the shadow is on that shot. It splits right through her eye. Which, of course, it's kind of the main area your eye goes to is right to that spot, and it's this big black hole, effectively.
Right.
So, the shadow would have been better used if it had been just cupping around the edge of her eye and shaping her cheekbone rather than dissecting the eye.
Right.
So, once again, to get that shadow to move, the easiest thing to do is to move her head. If she moves a little bit, that shadow moves in relation to where it sits on her face. So I often do the thing when I'm teaching this stuff is to do the old clown at the circus or the fates, where you put the ping pong ball in the mouth.
Yeah.
Get them just to move their head back and forth like their clown would do and just watch how the shadow and the light play changes.
Well,
and find a spot that is pleasing to you.
Okay, so use the modelling light on the monoblock.
Yeah, because you're going to see it reasonably closely. You remember the modelling lamps there is not just to make it easy to see in the studio if it's a dark studio. It's to be able to get some form of idea of where the light is going and not going. Yeah.
Like I said, but I'm new to this studio lighting thing.
That's why I thought we'd discuss it in a night. There's nothing overly critical about it. Yeah, I think some of the images are a bit hot.
Right. Yeah.
But once again, that could be a monitor and. Just think about where your shadow placement goes. And that's the tweak can be, it's a centimetre here, it's a centimetre there, it changes everything.
Yeah. What I would like to do is, one weekend is set this up again, find myself a model who's happy to do it TFP.
Yeah.
and then...
No, I get myself good for nothing.
Yeah, set up my laptop and tether so that I can view them on a decent-sized screen.
Decent-sized screen, absolutely. In our aging advanced years, Bruce, we need that help.
We do. We do.
It's very handy. The other thing is, too, you know, is... You can tend to feel under a certain amount of pressure to do stuff quickly.
Yes.
With models there, with other people there.
Yep.
Spend a long time getting the shot set up and a little time shooting. A lot of people do it the other way around. They set something up quickly, start shooting straight away because they feel that pressure to be taking photos.
Yeah.
But no, take your time, look, walk around it, look at different angles, think the process through, where's the light, where's the shadow, what's the story, all that kind of stuff. Spend 3 or 4 or 5 minutes to get that right and 30 seconds shooting rather than 30 seconds setting up and 5 minutes shooting, which tends to be the more the norm. But that's a pressure thing, especially if you're not used to shooting people in that sort of...
But that's an experience thing.
Oh, it is, absolutely. But that's why I say, though, it's the thing we have to work on is just try and have the confidence to take the time. But it's definitely experience.
Yeah.
Definitely. Anyway. That's enough picking on you, Phil. We've done that a few episodes in a row. That's enough. I think these are all good things to start to understand and think about when we're shooting.
Oh, definitely. Definitely. Yeah, and I think you're right. There was probably a little too much enthusiasm on my part to shoot first, ask questions later. So, anyway.
Which in some situations is not a bad thing to do. Cool.
Works for the Victorian police.
Absolutely. Hey, the lovely Carla Hemmings sent through he sent through the link to the keynote, opening keynote of Photoshop World 2015.
Yes.
And it's a great parody on Wayne's World.
Yes.
So, put that link up there. Anyone who's not a Philistine like yourself, Bruce, who's actually seen the movie, would get something out of it and think it's quite amusing. So. Yeah.
That is correct, people. I have not seen Wayne's World.
You probably haven't seen Citizen Kane either. They're on a similar part.
I did see it, but it was so long ago, I barely remember it.
Anyway.
Should watch it again. Anyway. David Marland sent us a brief thing on Facebook about the Ballarat International Photo Biennial, which runs this
Biennale.
Year. Hey?
Biennale.
Okay. Have it your way. From August the 22nd,
let's have it their way, shall we?
through to September the 20th. So almost a month. And
yeah, it's a great thing. Any person within Kiwi of that should really get along to it because it's struggling. There's not many of these grand, long-running photo biennales left in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I know financially this one's really struggling over the last few years because no one will sponsor photo exhibitions anymore.
Yeah, right.
So, if you like looking at good photos. And the great thing is it's a great area, the Ballarat and Dalesford area, the whole area. It's over a very wide-ranging area. You go up there, you can go from coffee shop to cafe to coffee shop to restaurant for a whole day, and there's little exhibitions all over the place in these places.
Oh, so it's not like just... It's not like just one big hall.
No, it's like 60 or 80 places around the whole area. Cool. It's like you can go up every weekend for the entire time it's on and have completely different experiences, see completely different shows. It's fabulous.
Nice.
Absolutely fabulous. And it's a beautiful area and it's nice to get out in the country. So,
yeah, right.
I did some workshops up there a couple of years ago not the last Biennale, the one before, I think, from memory. It's been a while. They all seem to blur into one. But, yes, it's a great environment. So,
all right.
And it covers such a broad spectrum of the types of photography that's being done out there. So it's brilliant. So
lovely.
Definitely going out there and whetting your appetite. So thanks for sending along, David.
Yeah. Carl also sent us a link to KarenHutton.com, who had a blog post about how she instantly and painlessly dropped 7 pounds on the mirrorless diet. This was all about her change from DSLR to a mirrorless setup. I think she was a 5D Mark II, I think she was shooting with. No, two Canon 6Ds. And a whole bunch of extra gear, and she changed to a couple of Fuji X-T1s and just about how much weight she no longer had to lug around. She was able to go to a smaller camera bag and still be able to carry, from a functional point of view, yeah. all the same amount of gear, but it was smaller, lighter, much easier to deal with. So, yeah.
That's funny.
Yeah.
I kind of like the weight.
Yeah. It depends. I guess it depends how long you're going to be in the field, and you know.
No, well, I mean, when I travel, I can walk for 18 hours in the course of a day, lugging it all with me.
Wow.
And it doesn't worry me. And trust me, 15 minutes of exercise here at home is a struggle, but I'll walk for an entire yeah. day after day after day when I'm yeah. away, yeah. With all the gear on my back. But I don't know. It's reassuring. I don't know. So I kind of like the weight. But I can certainly see how, for a lot of people, that'd be a big advantage not to lug all that extra yeah. stuff around.
Well, as I said to you after Borneo, I'm seriously liking the idea of finding a lighter kit to
yeah.
take,
yeah.
you know, whenever I travel next.
Well, speaking of,
yeah.
just arrived in my hot little hands today was my two new Tamron lenses.
Oh, nice.
My new Tamron to 15 to 30.
Oh, this is your two-lens challenge.
A two-lens challenge for Vietnam, yeah. So nice. I've just got the new 15 to 30 arrived today and my new 28 to 300.
Nice.
So I've got from 15 to 300 across two cameras.
Yeah.
And I haven't opened up the 28 to 300 yet. I'm going to do a video unboxing.
Right.
Unboxing video, I should probably say the right yeah. way around, of both lenses. But I had to open up the other one, the 15 to 30, because yeah, I had to. And oh my God, I pulled it out because I've never seen one in the flesh yet. This is the first time I've actually right. held one. I haven't been paying any attention to it. I haven't seen any photos of it.
Right.
So I had no visual conception of what this lens was going to be.
Right.
And when I pulled out the box, it's like, oh, I know photography is not about the gear, but oh, it's a sexy beast.
It is
that massive curved front element. Yeah, the sheer, once again, that heft in your hand. The thing's huge.
Is it?
Huge. Oh, it's fabulous.
What's the diameter?
Oh, about half its width.
Yeah, right.
Twice half its width.
72 mil, 77 mil?
Oh, no, it's going to be bigger than that. It doesn't take filters because the front element's so curved.
Yeah.
But it's got to be at least 82.
Right.
At least. It'll be 87, yeah.
Right.
But it's twice half its width. That's right. And it's twice half its length.
Yeah.
And it's twice half its weight, funnily enough, as well when it comes to I think it weighs like 1.1 kilos or something. Or
what?
It's a piece of work, I tell you. Wow. So when we're talking about loving the gear, yeah, it's astounding. So I'm hanging. I'm going to do that one in reverse. I'm going to go out and do some test shots with my 8-year-old tomorrow.
Yeah,
and then put it all back in the box and then do the unboxing video.
Right, excellent.
Just start on the cheeky side.
On
yeah.
the used
whilst I've got someone. Whilst I've got someone to shoot, yeah. you know, and I'll probably do the video on Monday. But so I'm now very excited about my two lens challenge because I reckon between those two, it's going to be pretty darn awesome. And I bought an action cam this week too.
Hang on, before we get to that, what's the aperture range on those two lenses?
It's 2.8 through the range on the 15 to 30.
Yep.
And I haven't even looked on the other one. I don't know. Right. Probably ends up at 6.3, something like that.
Right. Cool.
Yeah.
So you bought an action cam.
I bought an action cam, bought a Sony action cam. I thought I wouldn't be a GoPro, you know, wannabe. Or even buy a GoPro or any of the myriad of other ones.
Yeah.
But this one's so sexy because, you know, I love a gadget.
Yeah.
This one has a wrist remote control with a TV screen on it.
Oh, okay. Very good.
So you can watch on your wrist what's happening on the video camera.
Nice.
Which is good because the cameras don't have viewfinders or screens anymore, pretty much. So if I've got this mantle on my helmet, I don't wear helmets, got it mounted on my head or, the whole point is it's going to be mounted on top of the camera most of the time anyway, like a microphone would be.
Yeah.
So I kind of know where it's pointing anyway. But the remote control was so sexy, I couldn't resist. So I bought that this week as well. And I'll be doing some stuff with that in Vietnam. I mostly bought it for Holi. I want to do a video of the slow motion video stuff of all that.
Yep.
But I got this one cheap, so I got it for this trip as well, which would be good.
Yeah, right.
So that was it.
Can I make a suggestion?
Yeah,
I know you're not an audio engineer, but buy yourself a dedicated flash recorder that's designed to record audio.
Because I'm not going to do
in places like Holi.
Yeah.
Having a recorder to just record the ambience of the place will give you a much better sound than relying on the video camera sound.
Can't do audio. Plus, how do you protect the audio recorder from all the water?
You put a windsock over it.
Water?
Yeah.
You're being poured with, and drenched in buckets of water.
Right. Okay, well, that's going to be a challenge, but...
So you put it in a big plastic bag around the tape. There goes
and then everything sounds just like this.
Exactly. So I might be putting like a music background.
Fair enough.
Now, I heard a friend of mine texted me tonight from Brisbane, a tale of woe, which I must share with you.
Oh, okay.
She said, how far away do you live from... She texted, how far away do you live from the airport? Gone, oh, about 30 minutes or so. Why? She goes, oh... I said, why? She said, oh, I've just got back from Melbourne. She didn't even tell me she was in town. Not very nice. Just some friend. Just got back from Melbourne, and I seem to have lost my memory card at the airport, either in the hire car or on the floor near the hire car. She said, I remember having it in the boot of the hire car, and now I've got it nowhere. Oh. And she'd flown down from Brisbane, drove from Melbourne to a place called Swan Hill, which is about a five-hour drive.
Yeah.
To photograph her husband's aging parents
around the
childhood home that he'd grown up in.
Oh dear!
Flown back to Brisbane and it's like wop 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 wop. So here's the thing.
Yeah.
Leave the bloody memory card in the camera. It's a lot harder to lose a camera than it is to lose a memory. She's still got the camera.
But why'd she take the memory card? Why did she take it out?
I have no idea. So, yeah, it's just madness. So it's another tale of, well, I've been talking about backups and all that sort of stuff for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Those cards. Now, who cares if you lose everything else? Hold on to that damn memory card, you know?
Now, there was one other thing that Carl sent us, and that was a YouTube link to a video of a photographer who has got himself the palette series of USB hardware controllers. Now, we spoke about these things, I think, when they were still a Kickstarter project months ago. It appears that they are now out there in the world, in the flesh. And this was just a short 2-minute video on this guy and him, you know, using these controllers. And I've got to say, it looks pretty cool that you can, you know, you get individual, you know, knobs, buttons, sliders, and you can put them together in any configuration you like on your desk because they've got little connectors between each unit on all four sides so they can hook up any way you like. And you can then customize what each one of those controllers is designed to control. So you'd have a rotary knob for exposure and a rotary knob for saturation and, you know, sliders for highlights and blacks and whites and shadows and things like that. And I thought, ah, that looks so cool. So anyway.
You would.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, okay. Got anything else to talk about?
No, I'm done.
Okay. What are we going to do now?
Let's call someone.
Okay.
Who should we call? Let's toss a coin. You get to choose or I get to choose.
Joe McNally.
David Duchemin.
Okay.
Heads. What did come up as heads?
Came up as heads.
I win.
All right, let's call him.
Call him now. Bruce, surely you've got his personal number. Give him a call.
Hello, gentlemen.
Oh, David, how are you?
Very well. How are you?
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I'm Bruce. The other guy is Glenn.
Nice to meet you guys.
You too. Anyway,
what I've sort of done is my goal was during the week I was going to go through a bunch of your books and pull out just a few lines from here and there and just talk about them.
Absolutely.
But I didn't.
Okay. Let's not do that. That's a terrible idea.
That was the goal, you know. But I love the book Within the Frame. And so I didn't get past that one. And I didn't kind of get past half of that one because it's got so many bits of yellow highlighter in it. So I was just going to pull a few lines from that book and we'd just, you know, just talk about vision and thoughts. And I was going to talk about a couple of customers that I've been dealing with who've got vision problems. They're creatively stumped.
Yeah, the creative vision, not the actual vision.
Yeah. Well, I can't say either. Am I both? just talk about just the everyday common problems that people have, and how we all think about the process around it, and have a bit of a discussion. If that's all right with you,
it's absolutely great with me.
Shouldn't take more than 3 or 4 hours.
Okay, perfect. Well, I've got five blocked off, so we're good.
Okay, so I'm good whenever you are, Bruce.
Mate, we're rolling. We're already into the podcast, mate. So
zip.
Yeah. Wow.
Gee, we're professional.
Yeah, that was sneaky.
Fire away, Glenn.
Fire away. Well, we should introduce that David to everybody.
We should.
Everybody, David, everybody. We have 7 listeners, David.
Excellent.
As long as everyone's tuned in this week, of course it is. We have the 7 listeners, and they've stuck with us for 300 odd episodes, which is very lovely of them.
Yeah,
it's contractual, but still.
So well, that's what family's for, right?
That's it.
No, my family don't like me that much. So we're talking to David Duchemin, and now I've listened to about 15 introduction podcasts. Talks that you've done this morning while I was waiting for you, and I've heard your surname sort of and pronounced 15 different ways.
Well, you've just done it better than I have, so well really? Done.
Excellent stuff. Good stuff. With the first name of Glenn, I get all sorts of stuff anyway, and a surname of Lavender, I get looked at kind of strangely anyway, so usually I get mail addressed to Mrs. Yeah. Most people think of me as a woman, and that's after they've met me, unfortunately. So David is we were actually joking a couple of weeks ago, actually, on the podcast, that we were thinking of renaming the podcast from Shutter Zinc to the David Duchemin Hour, because we do talk about you a bit, you know.
That worries me.
In a stalking kind of way. No, because I find it incredibly frustrating in the world of photography that so many people, as I said, talking about gear or talking about Photoshop techniques and all that stuff's important. It's all stuff. I'm a gear junkie. I got 2 new lenses yesterday that I'm very excited about. I'm excited about one of them. So I'm always, and I love gear. I'm a bloke, yeah, but I'm not very good at it. I don't understand technology very well, and it always does my head in. So the world of photography seems to be so bombarded with stuff. So what I love about the stuff that you guys put out at Craft and Vision is it's not about that. It's about thinking about photography. And I get an awful lot more out of that, just visualizing stuff. So
it's more about the mental side of it than the physical side of it.
Yeah, I mean, just trying to stretch your brain a little bit more to try and figure out why you're doing what you're doing. Does that make sense? Yeah. So one of the things that I've noticed about yourself, David, is you have an unusual background in career choices and vocations in life, being that you studied religion and you were a stand-up comedian for a while.
Yeah, that's right. My mother's very proud of me.
Yeah. Well, she started off pretty good and went downhill from there, yeah.
Well, you know, there's religion and then there's religion. There was a while she was worried I was in a cult, and then, you know, when I entered stand-up comedy, she wasn't sure whether to be relieved or otherwise, and now she's pretty sure I'm back in a cult. So the only difference is now I'm leading it, she's very proud.
You're always better if you're leading the cult. Did you have to dye your hair blue and put like little blue things in your eyes to make your eyes look like they're blue contact lenses?
Well, you don't have to. That's one of the benefits.
All cults seem to have these blue-eyed kids with blonde hair. They're very freaky.
Sounds like you're describing Marge Simpson there, Glenn.
Yeah, you're referring to Norwegians, it sounds like.
Exactly. The Norwegian cult. Well, that's how I looked when I was a kid anyway. Short, really kind of weird bowl-cut hair with blue eyes. I hate my mother.
So, we're going to need this for 3 to 4 hours.
Just to get through my mother issues. So one of the things you talk about in your books is that vision is a reflection of personality.
Sure.
Yeah, and so I feel this is a very strong point, that this is why when you go out photographing with somebody else and take photographs of the same thing, your photos always look different because you're different people. So that really resonates with me. So here's the question, of course. How do you think studying religion and being a stand-up comedian affects that vision?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, those are, of course, not the only aspects of personality. But I would say that the reasons I studied theology in the first place, the kind of comedy that I did was not, you know, it wasn't the low-hanging fruit. It wasn't the easy jokes. It wasn't obscene. It was the kind of thing that you could, it was family comedy. And so I think if there's a thread at all through my work, it includes themes of, you know, themes of dignity and beauty and grace. And so I think there's certainly something to my character and my personality that sees hopeful things, sees beautiful things. Even though I can be deeply cynical, I still tend to point my lens at things that are graceful and beautiful and hopeful. And so you won't see a lot of the darker stuff out of me. And that's not to say that there's anything wrong with it. It's just not me.
Yeah, yeah. I unfortunately shoot a lot of models, and I always ask them never to smile in my photographs. So I kind of have the opposite. I like to. I don't necessarily like to see the happy smiley faces in my photos. and and in one of your books you say, oh, you just love that moment when the child smiles or breaks into the humanity. And whilst, you know, I'm a dad, I've got young kids, I enjoy that too, but for even my photos of my kids that I put out there, they always seem to have this stern look on their faces. So it's definitely a reflection of, I think, who you are as a person. My line with models always is that I ask the women not to smile because I'm married. You know, I'm just not used to seeing women happy. And that always gets a natural reaction. Yeah, so you photograph the smile that comes from that sort of stuff, which is always good. Yeah, so definitely there's a theme going through everything from theology to comedy to photography, and it's that humanity.
I think so. I like to think so. And that doesn't mean that a smile is necessary or that laughter is necessary. And not all of my portraiture has smiling, happy people. But what I seek in that is the authentic. I'm not interested in a smile or a laugh if it's forced. Yeah. And I'm also not interested in, you know, the moody, posed kind of stuff if it too is inauthentic. And again, this is my work we're talking about. I really don't care how other people do their stuff.
Absolutely.
But it will have an effect on what I am drawn to in the work of others. If I feel like I'm looking at work that's inauthentic or that I'm looking at a person with a mask of some sort, I'm less drawn to it than I am an authentic expression of our humanity. And that can be laughter, it can be tears. It's, you know, in fact, the fullest expression of our humanity would include both.
Yeah, so it's authenticity. That's always that old thing about there's a camera pointing at you, smile, smile. Well, it's always a mask. Yeah, it's always this fake facade we put on, so that genuine reaction, is it either tears or happiness, is a far more enjoyable thing to shoot. Absolutely, there's a line in one of your books about I was not looking to portray her as a sum of her wrinkles, but a beautiful, I think, to put down where she was taken from. But I think that's it. We often try and photograph, oh, look at that cool looking old person, and I'm guilty of this, and we're photographing exactly that. They're outward manifestation rather than who they are as people. Sure. And that can often show. And you put there's a line from Steve McCurry, getting the soul to peek out.
Yeah, and I don't think there's anything wrong with being drawn to someone based on their physical characteristics. I mean, I'm drawn to these characters all the time. It's just, I just like the gear question, there's nothing wrong with gear. I just want to go beyond it. It's just not the only question. And if we stop at the exterior of a person and just take our photograph and leave, we've missed the opportunity to make a better photograph, a more authentic photograph, but we've also missed the opportunity to spend some time and experience something, some even brief encounter with another human being. And I think that's, I hope, the place that I occupy in the photography world is this kind of person in between the artist and the geek who connects the two and just reminds us all, myself included, myself most of all, it is about humanity. And if your photographs are not about humanity, because they could be about architecture or landscape or whatever, then at least the audience, you have to remember their humanity and what will they respond to in this photograph. And I mean, that's, we talk about making better pixels as if it's just a matter of sharpness, but it's so much more than that.
Do you mean there's photos of things other than people you can do?
There are. Really? I mean, I don't know why you would.
Bruce takes landscapes and panoramas. I'm not really quite sure why.
Well, he's just scared of people.
Exactly. Well, that's often the case too, isn't it? I see that in my training a lot, that people, things like, oh, I never use flash. Why not? Well, I don't know how to use it. Or I don't photograph people. Why? Oh, I don't know how to talk to them. It's not so much that we're drawn to do one type of photography because sometimes we're scared to do another type. I don't do landscapes because I'm crap at it. But and then macro stuff's just impossible. You know, the slightest breath of wind and the thing's out of focus. You know, just I don't have the patience for that.
Well, landscapes require that you drag a tripod all over the place. So,
and what time of the morning do you have to get up?
Early o'clock.
Early o'clock, exactly, every single day. And what's the chance of something happening? Pretty slim. I mean, why would you do that to yourself? You can photograph people any time of the day.
You know? Well, that's true. The great hope of the landscape photographer, of course, is that there's Instagram filters. Exactly. I get up at least 2 hours later now that we have Instagram filters.
I just want a sunrise filter and I'll be right, you know, just that awesome, you know, what they call the God fingers, you know, straight streams of light and the beautiful cloudage, and they have like 15 varieties of that, and that'll do me.
Yeah. Did you just call them God's fingers?
God fingers, yeah.
Okay, so, well, that explains a lot of my landscape experiences, because I feel like God's been giving me the finger on a lot of mornings. so now I understand the term.
I really do a landscape, and I took one the other day and had these rays of light coming from the sky, and somebody on Facebook said, "Oh, I love your God fingers." It's the first time I'd heard the phrase, and that's kind of freaky. No, I mean it's interesting. Each to their own. But yeah, I find people an awful lot easier to shoot than landscapes, because you have kind of a bit of a control freak. Yeah, you have a little bit of control with a person. You have no control with landscapes, and no control with whether the bee stays on the flower or not.
Well, I think that's a very interesting way of looking at it, because I think there's a lot of people that would say exactly the opposite, that there is more control over a landscape than there is over the relational elements of working with a person and having to interact. You know, I go to landscape photography quite often after I've been doing a lot of work with people, because I need the break, and I feel like I can kind of just mess around and have more control. So it's it really does, I think, come down to this, to the individual. And it's one of the reasons I'm so leery when photographers start talking about rules and that sort of thing, is because there literally is nothing prescriptive in photography. I mean, other than that you kind of need to press the button of a button of some sort to make a photograph. Yeah. Everything else.
Oh, yeah, I think I can use your voice these days. I think you can say fire or you can clap. True. So you don't need to press the button anymore. Technology, yes.
True. Fire.
I've actually got photographer's elbow at the moment, where I can't raise my left arm towards my face. So I can't hold a camera to my face at the moment. It's a form of RSI. So if I don't have to press a button, that's one less bit of RSI I don't have to worry about getting.
Well, and if you're lucky, you won't even have to go outside. You could just, you know, program your computer to go out and do it for you.
I'm waiting. That's my landscape photographer's dream.
Hang your camera off a drone and fly the drone from the comfort of your armchair.
this conversation is becoming cynical way faster than I used to. I love Australians. That's actually,
you haven't listened to Shutter Zinc much, have you?
That's the side name of our podcast. Cynicalink.com. Exactly.
Perfect.
You mentioned in one of your books talking about photographing people, and this is the sentence: "Lest you think I'm an extrovert with incredible people skills, I'm not. It's just my desire to create images of these people is stronger than my desire to look like a sane human being." Do you remember writing that? I didn't write that.
I do remember writing that.
Yeah, so I think that's it. It's pushing yourself out of somewhat of a comfort zone. I do a talk on photographing, the art of photographing people you don't know. And so it's that art of walking up to complete strangers and asking to photograph them. And I've been doing it for 36 years, and it scares me silly every single person I walk up to. I may have just had a success and then turn around and there's another person I've got to ask if I can take the photo, you know?
I don't find that this gets any easier with time. Yeah. Every encounter is, and it should be, based on that unique individual and the kind of, you know, the chemistry that you have with that person. You don't know what that's going to be like. And I get these emails all the time from people saying, you know, I mean, it's almost comical, because they say something to the effect of, you know, David, I am so deeply afraid of photographing people that I almost never want to talk to one again. Can you tell me how to make better photographs of them? And I think maybe photographing people isn't your gig. Maybe you should be out there with, you know, with the landscapes by yourself. I mean, but I think unless you're completely sociopathic and have no ability to gauge a social situation, you're going to feel that empathy of, oh God, you know, what would I feel like if someone with a big camera approached me, and especially if they didn't speak my language and it should drive you, I think, to be a little nervous, and you can harness that energy and, you know, channel it into your encounters. It's just never going to get easy. But I hope if you respond to these situations with compassion and humility and respect, that even though it's difficult, I mean, I just kind of put on my old comedian mask. It was never easy for me to get on stage. I was the last person that you would ever have pegged as this kid's going to be on stage one day. But once I was up there, once I took a couple deep breaths and kind of put on a smile on my face and just went out on stage, it was fine. And I do the same thing with people. I take a deep breath and I put a smile on my face and I walk up before I can think any better of it. And I introduce myself in whether it's language or body language. And I just do my thing.
Sorry, that raises a question, David. You're talking about relating to the person, you know, on an emotional level before you get anywhere near taking a photo of them.
Yes.
How do you jump that hurdle if language is a barrier? Like, is there anything more to it than just, you know, a smile and sort of, you know, nod at your camera as if to say, hey, is it okay if I take your picture? Is there anything more to that conversation that can be had if you don't speak the same actual language?
No.
Right.
Yep. Okay. No, there, of course there is, but it's in the subtext, really. It is being compassionate, respectful, kind.
Sure.
Those things are communicated whether you open your mouth or not. I think there are people that are curious by nature about other people and that are interested and are, as I just said, kind and compassionate and all of those things. And that gets telegraphed very quickly by the look in your eye, by I mean, your intent. Yeah. Do you go in clutching your camera to your face? Oh God, just let me take one picture and get out of here. Or do you have the camera, as I do, sort of hidden behind your back or at your side? Mm. Because that's not my initial intent. My intent is, I'm going to meet this person. I'm going to, maybe they're at a stall and I buy something from their stall, or I ask them a question, or I just go and try out my really crappy Hindi or whatever. And they laugh at me and I laugh at them. I mean, you know, the only one that doesn't have any indignity in these exchanges is me. And exactly. And as long as you are okay with that and kind of embrace it, it's a lot of fun. And eventually you will have potentially, not always, but eventually you will have an opportunity to raise your camera. And when you do, you will have more time because the person will be less resistant. You will have a willing subject, and so something more authentic. And if all else fails and the photographs are garbage, you'll at least have a rewarding experience that you look back and say, you know, that was something interesting that I did with my travel, rather than just, you know, go from tourist knick-knack shop to tourist knick-knack shop.
Yeah, nice.
I have a little bit of a rule that the bigger the language barrier, the stupider the smile on my face becomes. So I walk down the streets with a stupid smile on my face and just look at people. And if they look at you, if you look at someone smiling with a certain level of craziness in the smile, if they smile back at you, you know, then you've got a connection straight away.
Yeah.
So I think that openness of being prepared just to walk around with a stupid grin on your face and hopefully get some sort of reaction is always a great opening point.
Yeah.
Sure. And really, when, I mean, if that works for you, I mean, everyone's got their own, you know, quote unquote strategies, but I think it is important to remember we're talking about human beings here, and no one strategy is going to work all the time.
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you just have to, it's a game of improv. You have to go out and see what happens and be willing to be playful. People respond to playfulness and joy, and they don't respond to that kind of predatorial thing that you see. Big lenses scare people. It's not, I mean, I don't care how big your camera is. In fact, I think if you carried around a 4x5 view camera on a gigantic tripod, you'd probably have a great deal of success because people see it as much more artistic and they're not afraid of that. They're not afraid of Hasselblads with waist-level viewfinders. What they're afraid of is big pro-looking cameras with a 300mm lens on, because they look sort of...
And the person holding the flash on the stand with the softbox and the reflectors and the makeup artists.
I recommend that you keep that person sort of behind a corner until your subject is agreed, and then you know whistle and they come running out with all their crap in tow. Yeah.
Well, usually the makeup artist is to keep me looking good, but you know, occasionally we'll use it on the person as well. You know, when I do my talks on photography, I always ask people, how many people here like having their photograph taken? And because when you're talking to photographers, most people prefer to be behind the camera, not a single hand ever shoots up. So it's, well, that's what the real world's like. You have to be prepared that not everyone wants to have their photo taken, regardless of how cool they may look.
Sure. Yeah. It's a funny question, though, because I bet all those people that answered or that didn't put their hands up have an Instagram feed full of selfies.
No, I talked to a lot of camera clubs. There's no one young enough to have an Instagram account. That's maybe only slightly true. I was doing a one-on-one recently with a couple of weeks ago with a customer who was just taking out photography, and he's just retired, so he's looking for that retirement hobby. And he hired me to do a one-on-one because he'd just gone for a 5-hour walk after doing one of my workshops to try and find something to photograph, and didn't take a single photograph because he couldn't see anything. He couldn't see anything to take a photograph of for 5 hours. So the first question I ask in that sort of situation is, well, what did you do for a living? And he was a project manager for very large industrial, you know, building projects. And so he had this very structured brain to the point where he has none of that creative flow and ability. He's got to sort of break through that barrier. So when you're up against a block like that or inability to see, what kind of thoughts or what advice would you give someone like that?
Well, I think, you know, I mean, obviously we all do things for different reasons. We all are drawn to certain things, and we're all at various stages. So some people just start photography because, frankly, they just want to play with cameras. And that's fine. Some people pick up guitars because they just want to play with a guitar and aren't necessarily interested in even making music, so to speak. They're just interested in the technical pursuit. But I think all of that, what it shares is the way we learn is very similar, regardless of your, you know, your artistic aspirations. And so I would say you go out and you do exercises, just like the way anyone learning anything in Canada, you learn to ice skate when you're a little kid, and you do these drills and back and forth. And you know, it's actually quite, go from one hockey rink to another and they're all doing the same drills. And I think photographers are the same. You need to go see what your possibilities are. So there's lots of books out there that will actually sort of say, hey, try photographing this. You know, photograph today, go photograph color. Today, photograph shape. Pick out some stuff that you can just go and emulate. You know, I'm going to photograph flowers or honeybees or straight lines or diagonal lines or whatever, and just do the exercises. Because before you start, you know, making art, you have to kind of know what the possibilities are. You have to
finger paint before you can do oils.
To get familiar and comfortable and to play. And I think in my experience, someone that walks for 5 hours is scared of playing. You know, they don't want to do it wrong. Well, certainly. And in writing, there are a lot of people. I mean, the nice thing about writers is that writers actually write about their process and about being a writer. Photographers generally, you know, if we were that good with words, we wouldn't be using a camera. So there isn't as much writing out there about how we engage in the creative photographic process. But writers commonly, I mean, the accepted wisdom is you don't start writing once you have an idea. You start writing in order to have an idea. Yeah. And that's where the work happens. And so if I'm applying the principle, you take your camera out on those times when you feel stuck and frozen, and you put the camera to your face and you just see what things look like, and you make some really bad.
We've mentioned that word before on the podcast. It's okay.
Yeah. Excellent. To help with
it. It translates. It's not just a Canadian.
you make some really, really shitty photographs of some mediocre subjects just to get the juices flowing. Well, I think photographers, we get very precious about this whole thing. And we have this expectation that every photograph we make is going to be good. And I had a student this morning email me and say, are all the photographs you take good? Because when I come home, I'm frustrated. And I'm like, dude, I come home from photographing. I was just in Mexico photographing these whale sharks. It's underwater. I'm learning. I feel like a kid in kindergarten all over again, tripping over my shoelaces. And
I said, you wear shoes underwater.
Well, that is part of the problem. How do you do these flippers up? Some Velcro. But you, now you've thrown me off completely. What the hell was I saying?
I came
back with 1,500 frames. Yep. And I could honestly say to him, look, maybe three of them are good. And I'm pretty sure that actually one of those is just a virtual copy of another and put in black and white to see if I like it. You need to do the sketch images. You need to play. You need to risk. And if we're all much less precious about this whole thing, we're willing to sacrifice 1,450 frames in order to get to the good stuff. It's just, for me, it's part of the process. So I would say...
And be prepared to admit, though, that you do take shitty photos. I mean, a lot of pros out there don't ever talk about the bad stuff, the bad photos they take.
Oh God, yeah. Absolutely. But, you know, I mean, I think some people are just overly serious about everything, and there's not much I can do about that. But I can tell you that in my own experience, if I tread a little more lightly and enjoy myself a little more and I'm less less serious about it, I do make better images. And I'm there's less angst in my life over those 1,450 that didn't turn out because they're sketches. No painter beats on themselves and gets down on themselves just because their sketch images are garbage. Of course they're garbage. They're sketch images.
But go and buy one of those Da Vinci sketches.
Yes.
and be prepared to pay. That whole point about, you know, we all take bad. People start on their Facebook accounts or whatever all the time. Oh, don't you ever take a bad image? Hell yeah, I rarely post them. Recently I did a day or two of posting my bad images. All my out-of-focus ones, my ones where I stuffed up the shutter speed, where, you know, I framed it completely wrong to the concept of what I was trying to shoot, just to put out a day of bad images.
And it only took you a day. I a decade and a half.
No, I can only find one card, let alone all the drives. But that's the thing. Yeah, that we take lots of bad photographs, but we work through it. Yeah, we as you said, you keep trying to refine the vision, and I think it's. I've got this great book on exactly what you were saying before about going out and doing the exercises. If you're struggling, what was it called? That's right, The Visual Toolbox. It's called. By some David something or other from Canadian. So that's a great book. It's 60 Lessons for Stronger Photographs. So if you are in that rut, sometimes it's, you know, doing a 365 project. Sometimes it's whatever it may be. Something that gets you doing is really important. Yeah, or some sort of structure might help.
Glenn, I was thinking, just as you guys were talking about that, I was thinking about, why didn't you suggest to him doing a 50-50 challenge? You know, 50mm lens, 50 minutes, you must take 50 images.
Because I hate the 50mm lens.
Doesn't matter. The point is, it would get him shooting. Like, if you went out and said, you've got 50 minutes, you've got to come back with 50 images.
No, I had a far better idea than that.
Okay.
I said, come to Vietnam for a week with me, and so he is.
Oh, cool. Awesome.
It works far better for my pocket.
Yeah, of course.
Perfect. So this is a strategy for... So I take it back. So if you're stuck in a creative rut, here's what I suggest. Email me and I'll put something together. I think the suggestion is valid, though. I think one of the best things you can do for your creativity, whether you feel like you're struggling or not, is to impose constraints and say, I am going to do this. I'm going to shoot with a 16mm, or, you know, I'm the same as you. I can't stand my 50mm lens. It's just useless.
It's the most popular portrait lens in the world, David. How could we be wrong?
I'm McDonald's is probably the most popular restaurant in the world. Doesn't mean I eat there.
Doesn't mean it's good.
No, I mean, the thing is, again, we do things for different reasons. And some people want that, you know, they when I first learned photography, they said that the 50mm lens is the closest to the way that the human eye sees. And that's on, but that's only in one regard. That's in regard to, you know, how much it magnifies. And but it doesn't include the idea of, like, for example, peripheral vision. I'm much more inclined to photograph something with my 16 or 21mm lens because I experience the world in a much wider kind of way. And when I make photographs, I don't want to just say, this is what I'm looking at. I want to say, this is how I feel about what I'm looking at. And for me, the 50 doesn't do it. And if I'm going to do portraits, I want to be a little, either I want to be wide and show that environmental context, or I want to be much closer and much more intimate and use something more like an 80. But again, it's the creative exercise, you know, even if you hate your 50. In fact, that may be the perfect constraint. If you really hate the 50mm lens, there's your exercise. Go out with a 50mm lens and make some photographs, or just shoot the color yellow, or just shoot pattern or line, or, you know,
contrast, or
Shooting, giving yourself a constraint is one of the best ways out of that creative rut. And learning, never being afraid to go, you know what, I'm just going to learn something new today. You alluded to it earlier. I can stand flash, but I started diving underwater with my cameras, and you know, as soon as you're 20 feet down, there's no more
color.
More than half of the spectrum is gone. So if you want color, you have to bring it and introduce it. If you want shadow, you have to bring a flash and introduce shadow. And so I'm, even though I can't stand flash, I just don't prefer it. I've seen some photography that's beautiful made with flash. I just don't like working with it.
Yeah.
But now I have no choice. And so that constraint has actually taught me more about light, even though, again, when I come up to the surface, I'm not using my flash. It's all about how we best learn, how we best create, and only people really can only understand that once they start trying it out for themselves. What works for you and what doesn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
And then come on my workshop, of course.
Of course, absolutely. You're going to Jodhpur next year, I think, from memory, aren't you? Yeah.
So I am.
Do you still have that one place left?
No, Jodhpur is that's all filled up. The trips I do now are so small; they're 4 to 5 people. Because I 45, really
45 people.
4 or 5 people.
Sure, same man.
Yeah, 45. Yes, I like intimacy. It's really
that closeness to each other. Absolutely.
The bigger the group, the less chance of me actually knowing your name, which is important to me.
And having to give you your personal time and learn what your struggles are. I've got enough of my own struggles. I don't need to hear yours.
See, you get me. I like that.
Before my last trip to India, I bought a 50mm lens, talking about the 50. I hate it so much. So I forced myself to tell you, but I get all my lenses for free. So this one I actually paid with my own money to force myself to value it and to force myself to use it.
Yeah, how'd that go?
Not well. Well, fortunately, I destroyed 2 lenses and a camera on my first day. So I was down from 2 cameras and 5 lenses to 1 camera and 3 lenses. And one of those was the 50 that was still left. So I kind of had to use it because of limitations of the lack of the rest of my gear. But it just doesn't, you know, it's like putting somebody else's shoes on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's put it on, it just doesn't feel analogy. Right. Yeah, it just does not feel right. They might be the right size, but it doesn't fit. Yeah. So it's a weird thing, but people who'll swear by it. Yeah, so that's what it's, everyone's different. It's okay to be different. One of the other customers who listens to that podcast, the lovely Reg Vardy. Hello, Reg. He lives in Bali, apparently.
Hey, Reg.
I keep getting confused about where he lives. So every time I mention his name, I try and find a different location. He's from Western Australia, and he's been struggling for a couple of years to through the battle of the fog of not being able to shoot. And I think that you've got to understand that. It's okay to struggle. Yeah, there's no end game here. Yeah, would you agree with that? You've got to fight through that crap.
I would say not only is it okay to struggle, I would say it's necessary to struggle. I think that's part of the human condition. And you know, not to get all black turtleneck on you, but the fact is the angst that we have or the confusion or any of that stuff. It's what fuels the best art of thousands of years. And I think it's great when people are struggling because it's, you know, there's no story out there. You don't go to a movie where there's no struggle or conflict. The greatest stories of all. I saw a great t-shirt in Mexico. It said something like, you know, no great story ever started with someone eating a salad. And and that has nothing to do with what I'm about to say, except that I wanted to get that in there. The great stories in life, they happen, they come, they start in, you know, the kind of the ordinary life, but they always kick in a high gear with some kind of struggle or conflict. And I don't know. I think if you're not struggling, you're probably not, I mean, in a big kind of sense, you're probably not creating much of interest. So I think it's okay and necessary that you struggle, but it's also necessary that you actively engage in the struggle and you keep trying and doing different things and seeing what you know, and putting it down for a while. Sometimes the best thing you can do is just put your damn camera down and go do something else. Go get a glass of, get a bottle, get a case of wine and, you know.
That'll help. That'll help your vision.
Drink absolutely. You know, that's I'm doing a lot of blurry impressionistic stuff entirely on that premise these days. So,
yeah, I'm thinking about those Indian smoke tents where it gets really, really hot and you start seeing visions. Yeah.
It's perfect. Absolutely. We all get there different ways, but I had something I was going to say, but I'm completely off track now. So
that's okay. We do that. We have no string to our bow. The one of the things is you have in your book again is stop trying to be clever. Sometimes when you're struggling to craft something when you're traveling, or you might be time poor when you're traveling. Something I struggle all the time is I have a reasonable amount of photo skills, therefore I try and be clever with them. And then the person comes along who's really struggling to even understand how the camera works because they've got such a simple way of looking at stuff. They just walk in and bang and take these fabulous photographs because they're not trying to be clever. They're just trying to take a nice photograph. I think that's an important aspect of getting past that struggle is stop trying so hard, you know?
Yeah, I mean, it's such a balance because I would say that I'm always trying hard, and there are some times when I feel like it is such an effort. I love it. Well, even when it's really hard, I adore it. If I didn't like doing it, I'd put the camera down and do something else. But I do think that at a certain point, some of this stuff becomes a little bit intuitive, and if the voices in your head or all the stupid rules that you've heard, and all the, you know, oh, I gotta try this with my lens baby, and I gotta do this, and I've gotta do that, and rather than just being simple and even a little bit naive about it, and I think sometimes we complicate things. The photographic industry does us no favors. I mean, you know, I just read an article about, you know, the first six lenses you need for your Fuji. I'm like, the first six? They make six? How many friggin' pieces of gear do we need to carry around with us? And I traveled in Italy at one point with this guy who, I am not exaggerating, had everything from a 500 millimeter refractor, you know, mirror, one of these old school mirror telephotos, to an 8 millimeter, massive 8 millimeter fisheye. And his bag was, I mean, I don't think I could even have carried that thing for a block. So, you know, how creative can you be and how perceptive can you be walking around a city carrying all that garbage? And then when you see something, the paralysis of, oh God, which lens do I use? Do I try my 500 and really zoom in on that, the eye of the pigeon sitting on top of that temple? Or do I use the 8 millimeter and show the whole city? And, you know, it just, that paralysis sets in. And you know what we come back with? We come back with nothing except tired feet.
And a chiropractor bill. Yeah.
Precisely.
I'm doing a two lens challenge in Vietnam next month. I'm only taking two lenses, which is not good for me because I drop a lot of stuff. So it could end up being a one lens challenge very, very quickly. But for that reason, the same sort of thing is to simplify it just for the sake of for a week to try. I'm doing a 15 to 30 and a 28 to 300. So two lenses take away a lot of the struggle with, which was going to be the rest thing to do. So we'll know in a couple of weeks' time whether that works or doesn't work.
Well, I'm curious when you say that because, I mean, some people would go, wow, two lenses, that's incredible. But you've still got 15 millimeters to 300 millimeters.
I know.
What are you normally taking in the way of focal lengths? I mean,
normally from 15 to 16 to 600. I beat that other guy. He beats me on the wide end, but I get him on the big end. He goes down to 8, but I go up to 600. Well, no, I don't carry very much.
I'm not sure you're really imposing constraints on yourself on this one.
I don't carry very much. I've only got the 15 to 30, the 24 to 70, the 90 mil, the 70 to 200, the 150 to 600. That's only five. That's only the first five lenses I need, and then occasionally I'll throw in that 50. I know it's and of course the two cameras, you've got to have a camera over each shoulder all the time. That's essential. So this is actually traveling light for me. It's going to be, we were talking about this in an earlier part of this podcast about, I actually enjoy the weight. Yeah, I like the heft of having a solid lens and a solid camera, where some of these smaller bodies, I don't know, being a big guy with big hands, it just doesn't quite feel right. So this is going to be a very light challenge for me. But some people, I know a lot of people are moving to these small Fujis and Olympuses and so on. They're beautiful cameras. But there's a woman who's did a blog post where she's lost 7 pounds in weight overnight, and she went from Canon to Fuji. And same focal range, but just a hell of a lot less weight to carry around.
I went to Leica and gained 30 pounds.
it's all that German food will do that to you. It's the sauerkraut and the beer puts it on big time. I love this line here, talking about vision and shooting and photographing things. It's the subject matter versus subject. And we often get carried away trying to photograph the subject matter, the person or the thing, and forget the story that we're trying to tell with the rest of it. We get suckered in or distracted by the subject. So we take lots of photos of subjects, but not necessarily the story of the subject or the story you're trying to convey.
Mm-hmm. Is there a question in there?
No. I'd like to say that. No. So that's the thing. I mean, how do we get past the subject and try and add a little bit more to that vision?
Well, I think for me, the simplest way to recap what you just said is that is it a photograph of something, or is it a photograph about something? And, you know, Alan Harvey famously said, don't shoot what it looks like, shoot what it feels like. And I am much more inclined to want to create and to enjoy, to look at photographs that are about something, that have a feeling of something. And I think it's helpful to know what that thing is about, because if it's just a photograph of a rose, you just aim your camera and click, there it is. If it's a photograph of, about a rose, then the question is, what can I exclude from this frame to make it the strongest possible photograph about a rose? What angle do I approach it from? What lens do I use? What compositional devices do I use to make this the strongest photograph about a rose? And what about that rose? Are we talking about the color? Or you could choose to photograph it in black and white and make it about the lines and the sort of the sensual lines within the petals of a rose. You could do. There would be 30 different photographs you could take, but they all begin with, and this is where it loops back to the idea of vision. It's, how do you see that rose? What are you trying to show me? It's not just look at this rose. It's not just showing me what you see. It's showing me how you see. And yeah. I think that is probably the most difficult leap for people to make once they have mastered the buttons and the dials, and, you know, which it frankly doesn't, in some cases, it doesn't take that long. And in some sense, it sort of takes all your life. I mean, you will always be mastering your craft. But at a certain point, that's the hard hurdle is, okay, you are very capable of making a well-exposed, well-focused photograph of a rose. Now I want you to interpret it. Show me something about this rose that I already don't see, that I already don't. Show it to me in a way that I don't normally look at a rose. And that's where individual vision and individual voice comes into play. And that's the challenge of the photographer. There's no book out there, mine included, that will tell you how to do that in three simple steps.
Yeah. You talk about having thought lists when you're going to a location. You think about, you know, what do you associate with these areas? You could do the same sort of thing with a rose. I mean, what are your thought process behind the rose? The softness, the smell, the delicacy, and how do you incorporate that into a photograph? Yeah, but yeah. So thinking, I think building a mental picture of what you want things to be, as far as the thoughts and the emotions that come to you, is really important.
Sure, and just taking the time to perceive. I mean, I think most photographers think that the job of a photographer is to make photographs, but actually our primary job is to perceive, to be observant. And how many people that have photographed a rose have really sat with that rose for long enough to really see where the lines are and the shadows and what the various angles are. We too often take the easy way, the obvious approach, and just, you know, get the camera up there and put it on a third or, you know, whatever, and make a photograph. It's much harder to spend time and be perceptive and have an opinion. I don't love roses. I don't actually like roses at all. There's 3 million flowers I prefer. Can I make a photograph that tells you, that shows you my opinion of roses and doesn't show it for its kind of, in my opinion, its sort of cliche beauty shot? Sure, I can. You know, I wait until that thing's wither and dying, and I will be much more interested. And I'm really not being facetious about it. I think a drying rose with the texture and, you know, it stops being that crimson red and starts being all kinds of shades from white to brown to black, that actually is much more interesting to me. But it takes, you know, it probably takes a certain amount. I don't photograph flowers generally. It probably takes a certain amount of courage to say, I'm not going to photograph for 2 weeks because I got to let this rose die and then photograph it. You know, that to me is the interesting challenge of being a photographer, is finding out where our vision takes us uniquely and exploring and playing. And maybe I make 50 pictures of the rose and they're all crappy sketch images, but at least I've looked at it from a different angle.
That at least adheres to your previous comment about, you know, don't show me what you see, show me how you see.
Yeah.
Yeah. Cool. Sorry, there was no question in that. I was just making an observation.
So we
just
had
thought we were taking a moment for reflection.
That works so well on radio. Deadly silence. No, I just had an addition to the podcast just joined me for a couple of minutes. My 4-year-old came and sat in my lap and thought, oh, it's going to go ugly very quickly. But she came in and she left without making a noise, which is unusual for her.
Right.
After her father. So thinking about those thought lists and expanding on that, you know, one of those things is when you're traveling, how you build up your thought lists, you're identifying your preconceptions of what a place is. Now, what's your sort of process? Has that changed much over the years of all the places you've been to?
Yeah, I mean, I usually sit down and kind of try to identify my preconceptions or my expectations about a place, and then, you know, have a moment of quiet reflection to realize those expectations are probably not going to pan out at all. I think our expectations can be so blinding in the photography process. You know, they stop us from seeing our expectations. They open our eyes to seeing what we expect to see a place, and we never get to see the place the way it truly is. So that's one thing, is just kind of reminding myself of that and asking myself frequently, you know, are there expectations? Are you expecting this place to look or feel a certain way when it just isn't? Because that's often my main source of frustration. The other thing I do is a visual inventory, and that's sort of more on the positive side. What am I seeing? And I write down either in my iPhone or my little notebook things that I see visually that excite me about a place that I think are sort of unique identifiers. You know, if I land in Addis Ababa in Ethiopia and I notice that the taxis are all blue and they're, you know, the crappy Ladas or whatever, you know, it's just these distinguishing things that I go, oh my God, that's amazing. You can't always stop and shoot the first example of, oh my God, that's amazing, whatever it is. And often the first incidence of that thing is not always the best expression of it. So yes, you could photograph a camel. And this again comes back to the idea of photographing, what is the photograph of or what is it about? Well, if you just want a photograph of a camel, go to your local zoo and don't leave the country. If you want a photograph that really says, you know, not just camel, but here's what it looks and smells and feels like to be in the desert with a herd of camels at sunrise as they go to the watering hole, then you need to find a place where it's sunrise, a desert full of camels and has a watering hole. That may not be the moment you're in the vehicle driving down the highway and see your first camel. Oh, stop. You know, you don't have to stop for that, but make a note. You know, if you really resonate with camels, I love camels. I mean, I don't want to get any closer to them than I have in the past, but I like photographing them. I love their shape and I love the sound they make when they walk. But for me, I just a picture in the middle of the day of a crappy camel, that's not going to cut it. So I start writing these things down and I just think about the possibilities. So when someone says, hey, where do you want to go tomorrow? I can go through my list and go, hey, is there any chance there's a watering hole that the camels will show up early at and we can get out early and see what we can find? That sort of thing is really, really helpful, both in reining in my expectations, but in also in just kind of keeping, I don't keep shot lists per se anymore, but I do keep this kind of, I call it my visual inventory. What's actually there and what's stirring my imagination?
Whew, I only dropped out of my internet fell out for most of that answer. So for the first time ever, I'm going to have to listen to the podcast to hear what was just said. I can skip through though. I think that we say you don't keep shot lists anymore, but you have thought lists. I think that building a list of shots that we want to take is so dangerous because we go blind looking for that, and we might miss all this great stuff because we're looking for this one thing we want to shoot.
Yeah, we almost definitely will miss what is actually there.
All the great stuff that, you know, all the fabulous stuff that you didn't know the place was about, that might be more in tune to what the place is about now. You mentioned in one of your books again that we're not photographing a place. We're not trying to represent the place, just interpret our version or the experience we have of a place on that particular day, and that can change with the season and the times of year with light times of day and so on. And that's, I think, one of the problems with a shot list. I'm going to go shoot the birds in front of the mosque flying in the air. Well, what if you go to the time of year when the birds are hibernating or something, or you know, they're not in that area? You know, your whole visual concept's kind of skewed.
Absolutely. And you will miss the fact that, climate is another great example of that. Weather, you show up and you have something in mind and it's shrouded in with fog and you think, well, son of a gun, I can't shoot what I wanted to. Missing all the while this incredible fog and the way that it isolates so beautifully, and you know, you'll be bitching and whining yourself. Meanwhile, some incredible things are happening in this fog. And so it does, I think it behooves us as photographers to be just really perceptive And yeah. if you can identify those expectations early and just kind of hold them, I'm not saying scuttle them all together, just hold them with a bit of an open hand and say, okay, yeah. here's what I expect. But why? Why do I expect that? Well, because I saw a picture on National Geographic or a postcard or, you yeah. know, let's face it, if it's your expectation, the photograph's probably already been made and possibly by a photographer much better than ourselves. So it would be an easier starting point to go in with a, hey, you know what? I'm going to wander down any street. I'm just going to pick one, not the one that everyone tells me I should go down, but I'm just going to pick one because at least then you have the chance of being surprised by something great rather than just, you're on your way to the Taj Mahal and you just, oh, I'm going to shoot the Taj Mahal. And it's going to look like this and it's going to be so great. Meanwhile, you've 10 blocks of interesting stuff has passed you by. And yeah, you get to yeah. the Taj Mahal and it's nothing but profound disappointment because there are 100 people just like you with, you know, trying to get into the same spot you're trying to get in and take the same photograph that everyone's yeah. taken for the last 50 years.
Yeah. Go buy a postcard. Yeah.
Sure.
The person who took the postcard's probably in far better light than you're ever going to be in. Yeah. It's usually the case when you travel. They've got the time to be there every day waiting for the great light and you've got that morning.
Yeah, they might have, or they just, you know, applied an Instagram filter, either one.
Yeah, the sunrise filter, of course, the Godfinger filter. I forgot about that one. I love you've got in your creative vision videos, which I love. I think they're one of the best resources we've got out there to while away 8 or 12 hours. Your definition of Robert Karp is if your photos aren't good enough, you're not close enough, which is a fairly well-exercised mantra, but you take it to being more about as well as being understanding more about the place you're going to. The more you can understand, the more you can know of a place, the closer you are to being, therefore the chances that your photos are going to be better for it. I think this really applies especially to anything like religious festivities and things. I'm off to Holi next year in Vrindavan in India, and I'm trying to absorb as much as I can about what that actually is about, because if you don't know what it's about, how can you photograph it?
Yeah, I think mantras are, by their very nature, people prefer to repeat mantras than understand them. And, you know, when Robert Capa said,
in for a pound, I say.
Exactly. Well, you know, when Capa was talking about getting closer, he certainly meant physical proximity. But I think we can go one better. I think we can also spend the time. And if you get closer in your understanding, if you spend time, the more intimate you are with the subject, the more you know, for example, what kind of creative possibilities are there. If you just zoom into the Taj Mahal and you're like, I've got 45 minutes to nail this iconic photograph and then I got to go somewhere else, you're not, except by some crazy fluke, you're not going to get the same photograph that someone who spends hours there or days or weeks, you know, we're all different, but the more time we spend, the greater the possibility that we will see it from a different angle, that we'll see something that we didn't see before. And, you know, it could be that going to Holi and photographing, the more familiar you are before you get there, the greater the chance that you can just get to work sooner. You just have to remember again that those expectations, no matter how familiar you are with them, those expectations can still stand in your way if they prevent Absolutely. You from seeing something, you know, really astonishing.
I need to get a photo of the guy throwing the bucket of water over this person. Well, yeah, you might be in trouble, you know. Yeah, exactly. So you've been to a couple of places around the planet.
A couple, yeah.
Where do you long to go still? Where's the desire to go that, yeah, it's like the final frontier that
that list is getting shorter and shorter. In fact, the places right now that I long to go are places that I've already been.
Yeah.
I see an interesting thing with new photographers that they do go to new places all the time and they pack their itineraries and they do have, you know, 2 hours at the Taj Mahal before they have to be on a on another train to go somewhere else and they go once and then they move on. And of course, I have the luxury now of having seen a lot of these places and so the fire in my belly isn't quite as strong. But I now want to go back to these places, to some of them. God knows it's not the Taj Mahal. I've had my fill of that. Most people I know only have to go to Agra once in their life. I went twice, and that was three times too many. But the places I long to go, I want to go back and I want to explore them more deeply and take more time. I have a village in northern Kenya near the Somali border that's very close to my heart, that feels a little bit like home, and I would love to go back there. But in terms of places that are unseen, increasingly they're underwater. I am loving the underwater stuff, and for a while I wrestled with it because I made my bread and butter with humanitarian photography for a while, and what's a humanitarian photographer doing underwater? But in part, one of my, you know, it comes all the way back around to our vision being sort of, it's part of who we are, and part of who I am, and my concern for, you know, for humanity and for this planet. I think the greatest humanitarian task of our generation, you know, aside from being a climate change denier, would be to take care of the oceans and to tend to the great damage that we have done to this planet. I do believe that the climate is changing incredibly detrimentally. And one of the conversations I want to be involved with is how that is affecting the ocean, because that's, you know, that's where life comes from. And if we destroy this planet, it's not a question of do you save the humans or do you save the whales? It's a question of both. It's not one or the other. And humans are so prone to, well, is it this or that? Yeah. And I'm not a big fan of or. I'm a big fan of and. Let's do both. And I think, you can serve in a humanitarian capacity, which I do and strongly still believe in. But I also believe that if we wipe out this planet, unless we have a really aggressive space program, we're in deep trouble. Yeah. And so, so that's on top of that, it's not just my feeling of obligation is the wrong word, certainly there's some of that. But I just find life under the ocean, under the water, incredibly beautiful and full of color and mystery. And it's something, you know, these days, and I don't mean this as cynically as it's going to sound, but these days every photographer that's got a tripod and a set of filters is going to Iceland. And don't get me wrong, I love Iceland. I've been there and I'd love to go back. But I'm kind of tired of bumping into other photographers. And I'm sure there are other photographers that are tired of bumping into me. When I create, I like to be alone. And one of the beautiful advantages of being under the water is nobody's talking to me. The voices kind of get silenced and I can just do my thing quietly. So there's lots of places on this planet that I would love to go. Some of them, in fact, with other photographers, because I do like people a great deal.
Sure. It sounds like it. It does.
I do very much. But I do get, I think like anyone, especially people that run workshops and stuff, I get a little peopled out. And so I love my time with people, but I do need, once I'm done, to go off into the desert somewhere or get into the water and just have some kind of recalibration time. Because most of us, we may learn quite well with other people, but in terms of actually creating and doing what we do, most of us do better alone than we do. Yeah. So we may think we do better with others because it's easier. It's less fear. We're less fearful of it. But going out and doing it alone is where most of us seem to be the most fruitful.
Yeah, I run around 100 to 120 workshops a year and several photo tours and things like that. So once a year, I just have to take myself somewhere for a week just by myself, just to walk for 15 hours a day and photograph, just to get away from because I find in training you do a lot of repetition, and that repetition really kills the creativity. I find it very hard to be creative at workshops because I'm teaching the same thing over and over again, and it can be quite stilting. So I definitely agree that time to be away, maybe I need to do underwater photography too, just the time to be away from other voices is really good.
Yeah, you will never hear another photographer ask, you know, what their f-stop should be when you're underwater. At best, you just hear some muffled, it's fantastic.
Yeah, all the screams because of the shark. The shark's coming behind them. But other than that, so you don't want to go to another place. You're going to another world, effectively. Yeah, underwater.
Yeah, really and truly. And I also find that I can be my most creative when I'm being pushed and I'm learning new things. And this whole underwater thing has been an incredible learning curve. I mean, I'm not just back to like, you know, grade two. I'm back at kindergarten with the crayons, but the really big chunky crayons, you know, and I thought I knew what I was doing with this craft. And now I'm back to tripping over myself. It's as long as you can approach it with a sense of humor, it's a lot of fun, but my God, it's challenging.
Absolutely. I think, especially as I said, if you've been doing this for a while, getting out of that comfort zone is really, really important. Otherwise, you'll find yourself. I'm sure no one wants to paint the Mona Lisa over and over and over again. You know, once or twice is enough, sort of thing. So I find that at times I get very frustrated with my own photography in that I take the same photos all the time, and it's a tricky mold to break out of. I think it doesn't matter whether you're struggling to see something or struggling to see something different. It's all part of the process.
Yeah, we're seeing it very clearly and just struggling to express it. You know, I think, here's the most challenging part about this whole vision stuff is that it's not like you discover it once and you're good to go. We change and we grow, and our vision, you wake up on a Sunday and it's not the same as it was on a Saturday. And so it's shooting at this moving target, and that for me is where some of the fun is. But it can be really challenging because you think you've nailed it, and one day you wake up and, your business card says you're a portrait photographer. But, you know, there's this funny line with my first book, Within the Frame, that says something to the effect of, I don't shoot a lot of landscapes, but... And I look back at it, I'm in the middle of sort of doing a second edition, which will be out sometime next year, and reading through some of this stuff and going, I've changed, not just what I'm drawn to, not just my approach, but whole areas of my vision have changed. I photograph a lot of landscape. There's probably people going, really? He photographs people? I thought he was a landscape photographer. because we change, and I think...
Was Instagram around when you did the first edition?
It was not.
So there you go.
It was not. So now I have a whole variety of filters available to me that I didn't initially, which is it bodes very well.
Books about. You've got the Instagram chapter.
Yeah. Well, one of my books does have a chapter called the Unsuck Filter. but back then I had this crazy idea that there was no such thing. Now there is.
Well, I created one in Photoshop. I made a filter and called it the Unsuck Filter and put it up for sale on the internet and got quite a lot of interest. It was kind of funny.
Perfect.
I have a lot of time at home doing nothing. I have to entertain myself.
Well, the sad thing is you seem to be joking about it, but there are people, in fact, you know, that are making quite a lot of money selling these things. And I have no problem with presets and actions, but, you know, this nonsense about take a mediocre shot and with the click of a button, it can become a great shot. Look, if your stuff is that close to greatness that all you need is a little spit and polish, it's already a good shot. And if it's not, no filters are going to make it compelling.
No, you're just not using the right action. You've got to find the right one. There's a lot out there. You're just not using
the right
one. Just
keep pressing the button. Something different
will happen. Keep buying more actions. One of them's going to do it. I love Within the Frame. I've got pretty much all of your books. It's one of those things. I keep getting gifted your books, which is kind of nice. My wife's, I think she's just added your bank account by at least 20 or 30 cents a book.
I'm grateful.
That's about your commission. But I think Within the Frame, I think as a starting point for people, especially travel, is a fabulous book. So I recommend it to everybody. And said the tour I'm taking to India in March, I'm buying everybody a copy. I think it's essential pre-travel reading to try and get your brain into that space, which is really good. So I'm looking forward to edition number two.
Thank you.
When it comes out. And I think you know, if Bruce has nothing else to add, I've got other stuff. We could waffle on for hours, but no, you know, the kids are starting to stir and want their breakfast, and I've already been disturbed by them twice. But also, yeah, we're mindful of you giving us a good chunk of your time for the day, which is much appreciated.
Thank you,
Bruce. Got anything else you'd like to add?
No, I've been happy just sitting here listening. So.
Well, I think we should have an apology to our listeners before we go too much further. Yeah, we try very hard not to put too much useful content in our podcast, David. And today, I think we may. Yeah, I think we've got at least 100 episodes of useful content, so we don't have to do anything else for the next 99. Fabulous.
Well, I think this is what editing's for, right? I mean, I think you can cut out the useful bits.
You edit?
That's right.
you edit? Apparently, Bruce does. He apparently edits this podcast. It was news to me. I thought all the blather went straight live to air, but I've never listened to an episode, so I wouldn't actually know what comes out the other end. But thank you. I don't want to hear my own voice. Enough of that as it is. Thank you so much for your time. We do appreciate it. And,
yeah, you're very welcome.
And hopefully at some point the track we can, you know, after what, I always call it What the Fuck, which is not, you know, Within the Frame, WTF.
You know, when that book came out and I started referring to it as WTF, I had so many people that, you know, I don't know if they were indignant or they just thought I was a moron, or but they would write emails. Do you know what WTF really means? I'm like, well, I'm not stupid. I mean, it just happens to be. Yeah, you can't consider all possible acronyms before you name things in life. It just, you know, happened to work out that it, you know, plays well in both areas.
It works, yeah, it works. So thank you, and go enjoy the rest of your weekend. Or your weekend hasn't started yet. We'll go enjoy our weekend. And
I live in a perpetual weekend, so this is fine. But hey, let's do something when our paths finally cross in Australia. I'm hoping I get to the bottom of the world next year, and nice. we'll spend some time.
What's your thoughts of coming down for? Is there an event? Or is there something you're coming down for?
There's been some conversation about getting me down there for some events and stuff. And when I'm a little clearer on what those are, then I'll certainly, you know, let people know. But I've got a lot of fans and followers in Australia and New Zealand, et cetera, that I would love to connect with. So I, once I'm down there, I plan to spend a little time, not as much as I should, but so we'll make sure maybe we can do one of these podcasts live or something.
Yeah, absolutely. Because Bruce is in Sydney, I'm in Melbourne. If you go to Canberra, which is sort of halfway between the two, perfect.
Excellent. It will be functionally exactly the same as doing it from here.
That's great. Right.
That worked out well.
That'd be good. We can certainly meet up and do something. That'd be wonderful. So thank you for your time. And
very welcome, Jim.
Get gone. Thanks, mate. That was awesome.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Yeah, absolutely my pleasure.
Enjoy your weekend. See you, dude.
Thanks. Take care.
See you, Bruce. Have a nice weekend, Bruce.
Yeah, you too, mate. Bye.
Shutters Inc., another audio2u.com quality podcast. For previous episodes, check out shuttersincpodcast.com or search the iTunes Music Store. For questions, comments, and feedback, email the boys@shuttersincpodcast.com.